You must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos will satisfy him. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No. He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
We will bring the Lord too by using one.
Not blaspheme, Malachi. You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
I think not, Isaac. You are the one who's lost favor with him. He's the god of blood and sacrifice, not ceremony.
Lie! Sacrilege! Down on your knees, heretic!
Shut your mouth, Isaac. You've grown prideful apart from us! He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Don't just sit there. Seize him, punish him, cut him down. I command you. I am the word and the giver of his laws. Disobedience to me is disobedience to him. Do it now, or your punishment shall be 1,000 times 1,000 deaths, each more horrible than the last.
They are tired of your talk, Isaac. I've shown them what I can do. Cut the woman down. Put Isaac in her place. Yeah, we will see how the Lord favors you.
No, you dare not, you blaspheme. He will punish you. The jaws of hell will devour you. All of you. No.
Hello, everyone. This is Gruesome Herzog. My very special guest is actor and now singer, Courtney Gaines. Courtney, how are you doing?
Doing good, brother. Doing good.
Thanks for coming on. We've been trying to get together for a couple weeks, and then we finally got to meet.
Yes. I had to work our schedules out, but we figured it out now.
Yeah, you are a very established actor from the 80s as a child. I mean, I was born in 68, so I'm a little bit behind you, but... I think one of the films that, as a 16-year-old, that really shook the core for me because, you know, I was only 3 years away from getting killed. But, Children of the Corn, 1984, I think was one of the most established films in my early life of watching movies, especially that opening diner scene.
Yeah.
You know, you got that cocky Malachi over there by the game, and the little boy looks over at him, saying that apparently the meeting was over. That movie, I'm pretty sure that movie kind of what? It kind of established your career?
I mean, it didn't kind of. It was overwhelming, the, you know, response I got out in the world. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden I went from, you know, being unrecognized to being recognized everywhere I went, and little kids running home crying to their parents when they'd see me and stuff. It was very, very overwhelming. And I would say, you know, what I did smartly in my teen run there was, my 80s run was, because that movie was such an impact, I didn't want to do another role like that. So I felt I'd be pigeonholed. So I really made it a point not to play the same character twice in that run. And I ended up having a really good run, you know, and successful in comedies as well as dramas, as well as horror. So that, and I think that really bode well for me for having a long-term career, because I was able to prove that I could play more than one character, you know?
And I tell you what, you were fantastic in there, because you were the role that you played. It's just, I mean, for you being what, 19, 18?
Yeah, I was 18.
And you carried yourself very well. The whole cast was phenomenal around you.
Now, yeah, that was a very good cast. And obviously a lot of people went on to work. So yeah, it was a good cast.
Linda Hamilton, Peter Horton.
Yeah.
One of my favorite actors is R.G. Armstrong.
Oh yeah, no, are you kidding?
Did you ever have any words with him, talking to him?
A little bit. I mean, he only worked, I think, that day, or it was 2 days or something. But I mean, I had seen him, you know, in many projects growing up. I remember, what was that movie with Peter Fonda and him?
Yes. Yeah, I'm trying to think.
It was like a heavy horror film, like. I can't think of the name of that thing, but I remember seeing that in a drive-in when I was a kid and being freaked out by it. So now I was getting to work with an established veteran character actor. I was excited. He was a nice guy.
I can imagine he would be, because I used to, when I saw him, it's weird. He's been in the business for so long. I mean, but that movie, other than The Beast Within in 82,
Beast Within. Oh my God. Yeah. That one was called Devil's Something. I can't think of what it was, but
yeah, he's been, you know, but for him to be Evil Speaks, another good one he was in too. He played Sarge. But it's funny though. But when I see his name, even though he has a career from way back when, it always comes back to Chosen the Corn.
Interesting.
Because he was the guy in the garage, you know. And I'm going to ask you a question. As an actor myself, it's weird. You mean the first part of film could be shot at the end or in the middle.
Right, right.
But when you read the script and you seen that diner scene in the beginning, what was your thoughts when you read that?
You know, I'll be honest, man. That was a long time ago.
I don't remember. I know.
No, it's okay. I if I could answer it, I would. All I really remember, you know, was that I just had an idea of what the kind of intensity I wanted this character to have, you know? And right. I would get myself, you know, I'm a method guy. So I work for what's called the inside out. So I'd get myself into the headspace and the vibe of what I wanted. And I would go into I'd run into the bathroom and look in the mirror and see if I saw the intensity coming out of my eyes that I wanted to see. And I didn't. I was like, okay, so I'm prepped enough. And I remember I kept doing that over like a month. And then finally, one day I looked in the mirror and there it was. And I was like, okay, I got this guy now. You know, I got this. I got the intensity I want to bring to this character. And for me, it was really just about proving to myself and to Hollywood that, you know, I belong, that I could do this for a living. And when I was done with the movie, I knew that I knew that I could. I knew that I would. And, you know, here we are 40 years later talking about the film. So I could have never predicted, you know.
Isn't that crazy? I think it's one of the most, I mean, for you to come up. I mean, I know it's your first major role, probably your first movie, right?
Children yeah, it's Lord. My first feature. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you do it, you move on, and then years go by. So when did you realize that, I mean, as far as horror conventions, when did you actually go to your first one promoting Children of the Corn? Or
I did my first horror convention about 15, 16 years ago. And I remembered there was this convention in L.A. at the, the Hollywood something or other, Hollywood Forever or something. And I remember seeing that going there when I was like 15 or 16 years old. And I just thought it was so like sad. You know, it was like the lady from the Beverly Hillbillies, she's 80 years old. She has the ponytails on. And I'm just like, oh, this is not what I want. So I was really not that jazzed at the idea of doing conventions. A friend of mine kept kind of prodding me to do it. Had a manager, Chris Rose, my manager now too. And I said, all right, I'll try one. I said, and really, it's not about meeting the fans that I'm not so keen about. It's about being in a room with a bunch of actors that I'm not so keen about. And so I did it. And what I found out was the cool thing about horror conventions is it's very blue collar. What I mean by that is nobody's so big an actor in the horror world that they can just be like, you know, I'm the shit, you know, and you all suck. You know what I mean? So it's like,
right.
And the people that go to them are very blue collar for the most part too. So I found it to be, you know, not so pretentious and such. And I'm glad I've done it because it gave me access to the fans. This was, you know, pre-internet really, at least in my world, pre-internet. I had no idea, example, how big an impact The Burbs had had because it didn't do that great in the box office. And it was right after Tom Hanks had Big had come out. So even the expectations were even higher. So it was not considered a success, quote unquote, in the theater. But it went on to have this serious cult following that I had no idea existed. So it's been great to have the access to people around the country, even around the world, and realize the impact some of this stuff's had. And in ways I could never imagine, you know. So it's been a good thing.
Yeah, because I saw something online the other day that they say that Tom Hanks's best movie was The Burbs.
I doubt that he would agree with that. And I certainly not anything he won the Oscar for. He only won a couple Oscars, right? So
right. But it's funny I saw that. I mean,
I sort of say there's two kinds of cred in the acting world. There's street cred, and then there's like critics cred, right? Street cred is a different animal. Some people have one, some people have the other, and then some people are lucky enough to have both. But The Burbs, as far as one of his movies, is one of the movies that has street cred. You know, it may not have critical acclaim, but it's got a lot of street cred, you know?
Correct. You also were in the movie you mentioned earlier. I can remember watching this too. Oh my God, I'm showing my age too. Hard Bodies.
Yep.
You played Rag, and it's kind of funny that, you know, when I watch Hard Bodies after Children of the Corn, I'm thinking, Malachi. What? And I was like shocked by it because I'm so used to seeing you in that role. And then I started following you, obviously, after the Children of Corn. There's certain actors I like, you know, I would go see what movies they were in. And then you did the one also I seen, Secret Admirer.
If I'm mistaken,
wasn't Corey Haim in there?
No, Corey Haim wasn't in Secret Admirer. The star of that was C. Thomas Howell.
That's right. C. Thomas Howell. That's right. I actually caught C. Thomas Howell. He's on TikTok talking about The Outsiders and stuff. So it's interesting to hear him talk about that. And then, of course, you went to the big one. Bigger. I guess it would probably be a little bigger than Children of Corn. Was Back to the Future. You played Dixon.
Still one of the biggest trilogies in Hollywood history. Yeah, small role, but massive success project. Yeah.
Now, as far as your role in Back to the Future, you said you had a small role, but small role doesn't mean anything. A small role is an important role.
Sometimes, right? If it has an arc to it, if it has an important moment, and that one happened to have an important moment, I think that's why people still recognize me from it. I sign a lot of Back to the Future posters at conventions, I'll tell you that.
That's awesome. So what was your experience like with Michael J. Fox, if you work with him, and Christopher Lloyd?
I didn't have any scenes with Christopher Lloyd that I can remember. So most of my stuff was with Crispin Glover.
He's awesome too.
Oh, I love him. I think he's fantastic. But we actually had a history. The first thing I ever did was this AFI film that they have out now as a trilogy, because they've done the same story three times. It's called the Beaver Trilogy now. Sean Penn did the role once. He did the role, and somebody else has recognized him, did the same role. Very strange little all short films. But so I always tell this story because it's just insane. So I get this job, the American Film Institute, which is this established place in Hollywood for actors to get started and filmmakers to get started. And so I get this, so I get there, and the guy's like, okay, so you're smoking in the boys' room, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, no problem. Because this guy just talking, improv, go. And we're talking. All of a sudden, the bathroom door opens, and it's Crispin, who I'd never met before, dressed in that black outfit from Grease of Olivia Newton-John. And he's doing the Crispin, like, hey guys, how's it going? What are you doing? And I'm watching it, and I'm going, like, at first I'm just blown away by the outfit, but I'm watching this actor who's like really good and has just an incredible amount of subtext going on. And it was just the most bizarre thing. He still says every time I see him, it's the best role he's ever done. But it was so great that when I got Back to the Future, he was the star of it. And before I even got out of my trailer, he knocked on my door and showed up and was like, hey, how's it going? And so it just made it. It's always nice when you come on a set and you know somebody already, especially if you're going to work with somebody you know. So that made me bullying him and, with it a lot easier. Like I knew what I could do with him. I knew what kind of actor he was. And so that, because you have to fill all that out, what people can handle and what they can't, or what they're comfortable with or what they're not. And I knew with Chris, when I could do just about anything, and he's just going to handle it, So it was great to get to work with him. And I mainly was just watching Michael, J. Fox from that stage pretty much the whole time we shot. I talked to him a little bit, but nothing with Mr. Lloyd, which, obviously he's such a brilliant comedic actor. I just freaking love him in Taxi. The best comedy on TV ever. And one of my, favorite comedic scenes when he's taking the driving test, and they're like, what do you do when you come to a yellow light? And they're like, slow down. He's like, what do you do when you slow down? Okay. What do? I remember falling off my couch laughing so hard. And I've seen it's gone on to be considered one of the great comedic moments in television history. I think it is. I think it's one of the funniest moments. And it was the first episode he did. Unbelievable.
That's awesome. I mean, the stories that you could tell. Now, if I'm mistaken, Crispin Glover's dad was an actor too, right? Was that John?
Yeah. And then he went on to be an acting teacher for a long time too. Yeah.
Yeah, because I know we're friends on Facebook. He wrote me the other day. I was like, what? He's writing me?
But yeah, awesome. No, he worked a ton. I mean, like 60s, 70s, 80s. Yeah, I know. So, Crispin is just such a creative, interesting guy. We got to do a mini series a few years back now called Texas Rising down in Mexico. And it was great to see him again and get to spend some time with him. it was a pretty straight role for him. He wasn't one of the, you know, usually his roles are like Willard and stuff like that, you know, so yeah. How creepy. It was a pretty straight role for him, but it was just great to get to see him again and hang out.
That's awesome. Now, you did some other stuff in the 80s too. Can't Buy Me Love in 87, which that movie I actually watched by accident, really.
Of course. Not exactly a horror film.
No, but I mean, I watch anything in the 80s, but Can't Buy Me Love, I thought was better than what it was better than what I thought it was going to be. Patrick Dempsey. I remember you playing Kenneth Werman.
Correct.
I had to look it up to confirm the last name, but
yeah,
what was your experience like in Can't Buy Me Love?
Well, it was a good experience. I was already a fan of the director, Stephen Rash, because he directed the Buddy Holly story, which I thought was fantastic. And, I know that it was a fairly low budget, and for him to make it be so good, I just had a lot of faith in him as a director. And that ended up paying off in the long run for me, because, the scene that everybody knows, of course, is the shit on my house scene. So by the time we shot that, we were, you know, about two thirds into the movie, and he was trusting my work at this point. And that was the only time we ever took a meet. Like, we went to the trailer with Patrick to like rehearse a scene. We'd never done that before, but it was a big scene, right? And it had this long monologue I had that said, like, you know, I was your friend. I did it for free. What I call extemporaneous comp, which I hate, explaining stuff. I don't like it. If I can avoid it. I understand it's a necessary device sometimes, but the audience knew all of those things already. They saw them all, right? You don't need to tell an audience what they already saw. That's at least what I believe. So he had faith in me. And he said, what do you think of this? And I said, I think all of this is bullshit. And he's like, okay, well, what would you say? I said, I would say one line, the one at the bottom, you shit on my house. He's like, really? That's all you want to say? I said, yep. I said, let's go. And that's what we did. And that's what we did. And it ended up being, a really powerful moment for a romantic comedy, a teen romantic comedy. Matter of fact, I always tell this story as well. So the guy who produced the project, his name's Jerry Henshaw. He, you know, he'd been in the film industry since black and white film. And he apprenticed on the Munsters. That's how far back he went. But that was my second film for him. I did a movie called Winners Take All. It was called Apollo Pictures. So Can't Buy Me Love got picked up by Touchstone, which was a new division of Disney. And they dumped a bunch of money in to do some reshoots to make it more tasteful. And they also paid up big for that title, which made a huge difference. But when he met with the suits at Disney, they wanted to cut that scene out of the movie, because they thought it was just too heavy for a teen romantic comedy. And this is a guy about 400 pounds. He told me, yeah, I stood up, I started pounding on the desk, and I said, you're not taking that fucking scene out of my fucking movie. Do you understand? And the suits backed off, and you know, the rest is history. Thank God he stood up for me in that moment, because that gives the movie some depth, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you already mentioned about the Burbs, but I'm going to ask you, what was it like? I guess Burbs turned out to be very similar to Children of Corn as far as not knowing how popular later on it's going to be. Because like I mentioned earlier, a lot of people love the Burbs. And I remember the Burbs came out, and you know, Tom Hanks was like going nuts away in the 80s doing all kinds of films. But
well, Big had just come out while we were filming, so we saw him go from star to superstar, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was like the breakout of the breakout, you know what I mean?
Right. So your experience with the Burbs, you got any good stories or your experiences with that one?
Sure, yeah. It was a good experience. There's some interesting things about it looking at hindsight. Number one is, particularly now, is so that there was a writer's strike on in 1988 when we shot that film. And I was just too young and dumb to realize how serious that was, because I was young and I was working and I, you know, didn't have kids or a house or, you know what I mean? Like, none of the things that an adult really struggles with later on in life. And so I didn't really appreciate the depth of it at the time, but here we are again, back in these big strikes. So literally, there was us and Fletch 2 on the entire Universal lot. It was a ghost town, just us. Wow. I mean, commissary wasn't open, nothing. And we shot nights, so it was even more of a ghost town. I didn't realize how strange it was in a way when you think about it. I mean, we're talking about an entire studio was just shut down except for two films, you know? Crazy. Pretty crazy. So that was one. Two, obviously getting to work with Tom Hanks. You know, I always tell people he's just the most down-to-earth A-list actor you're ever going to meet. And having a guy like that set the tone, it just, you know, nobody else can be acting like a prima donna when your lead's not, right? So that was awesome. And then I'm a huge fan of Bruce Dern, and he really took a liking to my work, and he really took me under his wing, and he really gave me some amazing compliments, and it helped me give me confidence that what I was, you know, the road I was going with the character, the choices I was making was working, because he saw it and he acknowledged it. And I got to do a movie with him a few years ago called Hellblazers, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. And it was so great to get to see him again and just tell him how much it meant to me at the time that he acknowledged the kind of work I was doing, you know? And that's awesome. And then just Joe Dante, you know, great guy. I've worked for him a couple times. I work for him again, any place, anywhere. I gave him a lot. All the look of the character was all Joe Dante. He knew exactly what he'd want. He'd send me, he'd be like, okay, now go get your teeth cast over at this place. And then you're going to go get your hair cut over at this lady. Then here, take this swath and take it to the wardrobe lady and tell her this is the material I want you to make. And then he would say, every time something's done, you got to come back and put it all together and let me see it. And so this is like what we were doing as we were prepping the movie. And he would just laugh and go like, you're never going to work again. know? He was hilarious, you know? So he was just really easy to work for. And he really knew what he wanted. A lot of times you're kind of left to your own to figure out things. And, not in his case, he helped really, you know, from the outside, he helped make the character very clearly what he wanted. And from the inside, my job was to, you know, like I said, I'm a method actor. I tell people what I worked with in this particular character was the essence of a deer in the headlights. And I think if you look at the character, you can see that that's what's going on.
Awesome. Now there's a movie here I'm going to mention that, it's kind of odd. I'm going to bring this up. My dad passed away in 2012 at the young age of 66. And one of the movies that he loved the most was Memphis Belle.
I was going to say, you're going to say Memphis Belle. I knew it.
He loved that movie. You played Sergeant Eugene McVeigh.
Yep.
I'm just bringing this up in my dad's honor.
Yeah.
What was the experience like in Memphis Belle?
Well, that's the one that all of us that did that movie, we've been chasing another one as great as Memphis Belle, right? I mean, as far as just the quality of it goes, it was you know, the peak of my film career, probably. We got to shoot in, you know, we were in London, we were in England for 3 months, got to shoot, which is a long time, and we got to shoot in famous Pinewood Studios, you know, which is, it's just the greatest studio. The commissary there is like a Sunday brunch every day, which, like, commissary, people don't realize, like, the commissary, like Universal or places like that, it's like, you know, terrible. It's like, you know, it's like a school cafeteria food, practically. You know what I mean? It's not great. But this was like, you know, a roast and a ham, which would you like every day, you know, that they cut fresh for, you know, like, it was like a brunch, you know, it was awesome. But so to get to shoot at such a great place, but also the level of talent on the production level was the greatest I've probably ever been involved with. There was 4 Oscar winners on that project. The producer, David Putnam, the cinematographer for Out of Africa, David Watkins, and then the production designer and the editor. And, you know, I mean, they're just talking like the top shelf talent in the UK. You know, so you know, you're really working with great people who are really, you know, just bringing so much quality to the ball game. So it was just an amazing experience, and it's a really good film. And you know, the timing on that one was unfortunate. It came out right as the first Iraqi war broke out, so nobody really wanted to go see a war film because no one thought that no one knew that war was going to be so short, unlike the second one.
Oh wow.
So the timing was bad, but you know, it certainly went on to do well in DVD and all of that. But it's a movie that I'm very proud of to be a part of, you know.
Yeah, my dad had a copy of that to the day he died. He never left out of his sight.
That's awesome.
Really loved that movie. Now I'm going to mention a TV series only because of the main actor.
Hey, I've done plenty of guest stars on TV. We can talk about whatever you want.
Yeah, In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah.
Did you have any scenes? I don't remember the episode, of course, but did you have any scenes with Carol O'Connor?
I did not. And Number one, I think I'm a huge fan of him and all of the family. Matter of fact, I've been watching it again recently. Yeah. I've been saying this for a long time, and I guess some critics would agree. I think it's maybe the greatest comedy, in television history. And the reason I say that is because it is because the way it was pushing the envelope, there's just stuff they're doing that you just can't do now. You could never do that show now. It's so unpolitically correct, but that's the genius of it, is you're watching this bigot, and all the things he's exposing about, bigotry in this country, it's misogyny you name it. But it's done in this way where you can laugh at yourselves and laugh at each other. And that's the genius of it. It's so great. It's so well acted and so well written. So I was really, really excited he directed the two episodes. So I was very, very excited to get to meet him. And I'll be honest, we got off on the wrong foot right out of the gate. And it was just, I didn't like the way he came at me. I'll tell you what happened. So like I had chosen for this character. So the first thing that I have to say is they wanted a real Southern guy. Right. And I knew this going in. And so I sold them that I was a real Southern guy. I told them my ex-wife at the time, their family was from Union Springs, Alabama. So I'm like, yeah, man, I'm from Union Springs, Alabama, blah, blah, blah. And I sold them on it. So they thought I was a real Southern dude. So I come in and he didn't know who I was. You know what I'm saying? And I had chosen a toothpick that I'd been working with it as a character thing for a week. It wasn't like something I randomly chose. And when I went up to him, first thing he did, as he didn't even say hello, he took the toothpick out of my mouth and threw it on the ground. And I was just like, I cannot believe, he's almost like he touched me, without introducing himself. You know what I mean?
I thought
it was like, I thought, wow, that was kind of an asshole move. Okay. So my great moment was that after about 3 days of shooting, we were riding in the van to the location, and he was in the front seat, which is where whoever the alpha is always sits on the front passenger seat. I broke my accent. You should have seen him turn around. He had that look he has on like all the family. And I was like, literally, I'm like, yeah, right, motherfucker. You don't know who I am? I know that. I mean, you think I'm just a kid who doesn't know what he's doing, but I just fooled Carol O'Connor, Jack. And now we're 3 days in and there ain't nothing you can do about it. And after that, he came with a little more respect, but unfortunately, that's what it took.
That's crazy.
But I love that moment because he pissed me off. I'm telling you, I'm a huge fan of that dude, but I didn't like the way he conducted himself. On a side note, I'm blanking. When I think, have to think of names under pressure, who's the guy that played the coach in Rocky? What's that actor?
Burgess.
Yes. Burgess Meredith. Love Burgess Meredith. So he had a recur on that show playing a judge. And I just happened to walk in a room where he was, and he was just sitting there, and we just started talking, and he's like, what role are you playing? And I told him I was playing the lead bad guy. He's like, the proverbial bad guy. And we talked for like 20 minutes, and he couldn't have been a nicer guy. Like, and it was such a wonderful surprise to meet him because I didn't even know he was there. And I was, you just never know what you're going to get. Some people can rub you the wrong way. And so then you get him, and he just turns out to be the sweetest, most humble guy, And I was so glad I got to, spend some time with him, because I was just, I've always been a fan of his. I'm a character actor, right? I love character actors,
Right. So I have a story. It's not on a movie set, but it was at a film festival. One of the things that really bug me is somebody who I'm a fan of, like his work, like you.
Right.
And for them to act like a complete ass.
Yes.
Turning off. And that was Sid Haig.
Oh, it was Sid. That's surprising. Sid. People usually like Sid. The late, great Sid Haig.
I don't know if he's in a bad mood, but how he talked to me, it kind of really.
It happens. It's a small world, right? First, the film industry is a small world. You hear about people, they're jerks, but also the con community, people will go have a bad experience with somebody and they'll come right to my table and tell me about it. As they're signing up, like, we were just at so-and-so's table. The guy's pictures cost a whole lot of money and he was like mean. And, I really don't understand that, because what I always say about the, look, here's the job. You sit at a table. People come up to you excited to meet you and pay you money to sign something. If somebody put that advertisement out as a job, it would be the easiest job in the world, right? It's not, you're not laying bricks for a living or roofs or something. And I'm like, if you don't want to be here, don't be here. You know, this is, you know, but some of these guys are just, they think they're better than that, or they're curmudgeons or whatever they are. But yeah, you know, they don't realize the effect they're having on people. These people are, they paid their money to go there, and they took the time to drive there to see you. Some people 4, 5, 6 hours to see you, and you have the ability to help make their day or break their day, you know?
Right.
And I don't know why you want to come off like that, but there are some people like that out there for sure.
And then, of course, I had a situation with Gary Busey and his son. We won't get into that one.
Okay. Yeah.
But they're kind of crazy, too. At least Gary is, anyways.
Well, I mean, Gary's, his son's great. But yeah, Gary, I mean, I love Gary as an actor, but he's fun at this point. He's not all there, man. That motorcycle crash did him in, you know?
Yeah, it did. God bless him. So, that's my little story about that. And, you know, it took me a while to get over it. I mean,
it ruined. I didn't want to watch. When I meet somebody, I'm very careful because I don't want to meet people, and if I think they might be not cool, because I know if I see them and I have a bad experience, I don't want to see their movies anymore. I don't want to see. It took me a long time to be able to watch All in the Family again, like I am now, and just appreciate it and not be attached to that bad experience I had with them. So no, it does matter. It does matter greatly. And I don't think some of the people who alienate people like that realize that. Like, I'm telling you, I don't want to watch their work anymore, because I'm just thinking, all I can think about is, oh, that asshole. You know what I mean? I'm not able to watch the film anymore, you know, or the TV show.
You know, I mean, I'm over. I mean, he passed on now, but.
Yeah, that's why I said the late great today.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, I'm over it now, but it really, I mean, how he acted reminded me of his role in the Rob Zombie movies. It's like, really, whatever. But, there's a TV series in 2008 that I fucking watched it every fucking week. I think it's one of the greatest shows in the 2000s is Monk.
Oh, Monk, yeah. I auditioned for that show several times. That's another thing I try to tell people. Like, look, you know, when you're auditioning for a TV, particularly in TV, you might have to come back 6-8 times before they cast you in something. But if they keep bringing you back, it means they like you, and it means they're trying to find some place for you. So you just got to keep showing up and doing good work. I auditioned for that show, and ironically, usually I end up getting the best role that I auditioned for. That's usually what happens. And like I said, I auditioned for that show several times, and you know, I ended up getting, you know, one of the crucial character plot stories of that entire show, the six-fingered man, right? The guy who killed his wife. I mean, that's a pretty, I was blown away, you know, that I got chose for that role, you know?
Great show.
Was funny. Yeah. That show, what was funny about working on that show was, cause Shalhoub was obviously so established in that show, so integral a part of it, that sometimes, you know, he and the director and the producer were all chiming in. And I don't like that. I just want to hear from the director, right? Just tell me what you want. I need three dudes' opinions. But again, Shalhoub didn't really know who I was, didn't know my work. And it wasn't until we had we had a fight scene, right? And they're running through the choreography, and he's like, you know, kind of talking, you know, a little bit down to me, like, so you got it? Or do we need to do it again? You ready to go? And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm good. And then we nail it in one, and then he's like, oh, like this ain't this guy's first rodeo. And I'm like, yeah, no. Sometimes, you know, it's just not everybody knows who I am, you know, or whatever. So they don't know, and they don't know my work. They haven't taken the time to look me up and see my long resume. But you know, I take pride in, you know, doing a good job. You know, doing my work and being a pro at it. You know.
Well, I'm going to move up a little bit closer. In 2011, you did, if I'm mistaken, it's like a remake of Night of the Living Dead. That's Mimesis.
It's not a full on remake. It's that these kids watched that and then act that out in real life.
Correct. That's what I meant to say.
And I just did a cameo in that. I've worked with the director twice now. I've done a few conventions for him out in Michigan as well. I'm blanking on his name right now. Shit. Troy. I'm not, though the town's Troy, Michigan. I can't think of his name. I tell you, Under Pressure, I forget everybody's name, but he's a good dude, and it was a good project. Came out pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good movie. It really was. Now, in 2015, Ohio was putting out some good horror movies at the same time.
And done a lot of work in Ohio since then. You're right.
The Funhouse Massacre was so off the wall badass that it surprised the shit out of me when I watched that and reviewed that one.
Yeah, again, I just had a cameo in that. I've worked with those guys a few times. The concept's cool. There's a haunted house who's doing these portraying these famous murderers. And then those real murderers escape and end up at the haunted house. That's a great movie. So people think they're fake, but they're the real guys, you know? So it's a pretty fun concept.
It's a great movie. I love that one a lot. You were also in the one that we talked about earlier. You were the Sheriff Sam Bramford in Candy Corn.
Yeah.
Candy Corn surprised the fucking shit out of me because the little guy.
Yeah. Pancho Muller.
He was so fucking creepy.
He was great. How I got that gig was actually through Pancho. He was the first one cast, and he brought me into the fold. He was with my manager at the time. We were doing conventions together. And then, that ended up being a really long journey because they had money problems in the beginning. And then I stepped in and helped produce a little bit and helped raise a little bit of money because I believed in the project and thought it was good. But we had to go back to Ohio twice in the fall when it was freaking cold and shoot because we didn't get it done the first time. We had to go back the next fall and, you know, finish off. And so it was a long journey, but the project came out pretty good. And yeah. And, you know, working with Pancho, especially that first time we see him in the trailer, he just kicks my ass in that scene. He was great.
He was great.
And I always thought they were going to spin this off into, I don't know how, I guess I don't think that maybe it's done that well box office wise, but I thought it was going to maybe spin off into a, you know, project that he could just keep playing Dr. Death, do like four or five or six of them, you know?
Yeah.
And I know just keep showing up into another town. More shit just keeps happening. Right.
Right. And wasn't Tony Todd in there too? Yeah, he was.
Yeah. Yeah. Tony was nice enough to kind of do us I won't quite say a cameo, but smaller role than he's used to. There was also talk of, I think there was talk of it. There was a sequel. His role was going to expand, but it was great to get, you know, I've been around Tony for years at conventions. It was great to finally get to work with him. He brought a lot to the party, you know?
Yep. Back in 2013, I was a celebrity guest at a Parafest in Bethlehem, PA.
Mm.
Yeah, I was, believe it or not. And Danny Glover was there, Michael Berryman, Tony Todd,
mm-hmm.
Cousin It, Wenzi Adams, who she passed away now, she was there, a bunch of them. And we were at the party before it started. Tony Todd was behind the bar getting drinks. Say, Tony, give me a beer. And we just started bullshitting for the longest while. I have a picture of me and him that night at the club. It's really, Tony Todd is an amazing guy. And so is his sister, Monique Dupree.
Oh, yeah.
I met her as well. She's a great actress, too. And I was sitting there talking to Tony, and I think one of the most greatest moments of my life is growing up as a kid and you watched old movies from the 70s, and there was Michael Berryman. He's on the phone. He said, Tony, give me a beer. He's my bartender.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I woke up with Barry and Berryman, and I gave him a beer, and then he hung up his phone, and you know what? We became best buds the whole freaking weekend.
Yeah, no, Berryman's a really nice guy. I've worked with him once, but I've also been at conventions with him. He's a really nice guy.
If you need something, he'll have him page me. He knew my name. It's so funny. I can remember when we had dinner, and I went upstairs because, you know, the ones that were, you know, celebrity guests or whatever. And I woke up there. Richard Kiel, who passed away a year later, was in his wheelchair.
Mm.
You had Danny Glover.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Michael Berryman. And then we were all sitting on the couches eating spaghetti. It was so fucking funny.
Surreal, I'm sure. Surreal would probably be the word.
Experience of my life, because I would shoot shoot questions to Richard Kiel. He would talk about James Bond. Mm. And then Danny Glover would talk about, you know, him and Mel Gibson.
Yeah, of course.
Mel Gibson a week later. And then, of course, Michael Barryman, he actually had me come back to his table. Because his person that was helping him collect the money had to go do something. He goes, would you mind helping me? So I was collecting money for him while he was signing autographs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the best way to get to know somebody, hanging out at their table like that.
And I would hear stories about all his movies that he made in Italy, you know, like the, I mean, to this day, he stays in contact with me on Facebook to this day. He's never forgotten. I mean, I think it's incredible that he never forgot who I was. He makes a note to write me right now and say, hey, Scott, how you doing?
Michael Barryman, like I said, he's a really nice guy. That's the kind of guy he is, you know.
Now, the next film we're going to talk about is you played Dr. Hewitt, and I actually came across this movie by accident. But this movie, I don't think it got enough credit that it deserved, and that's Wake the Dawn.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's a pretty ambitious film, and it was a fun character for me. And I was, you know, a lot of these cameo things in horror are jobs I actually get offers. I don't have to, you know, have to audition for and such. And that one came through another friend of mine who knew the director. But I adamantly was like, okay, I'll do it if I can do one thing. And that's like shave the top of my head to look like a real bald top. And they were like, okay, if you want to do that, go ahead. I'm like, yeah, I do. I never done that look. I want to do that look. So. They agreed, great. And that was. But it was great to get to work with. You know, I've worked with D. Wallace once before. We've done conventions together for years and years. Yep. It was great to get to work with her again. She's such a good actress. So,
oh my goodness,
always any chance to work with D, I'm there. So,
I love D. Wallace. Yeah. I met her three times at the same festival in Gettysburg, and horrifying, right?
Yeah, she's a force of nature, D. Wallace. She is a force of nature.
And what's so great about her is I met her the first year. So I came back the next year. And all I did was stand at the end of the doorway, the front of the doorway, and she was way over her table. I said, oh, my God, it's Dee Wallace. She literally ran to me. She remembered who I was. And those are the ones that you cannot ever forget because they appreciate their fans and they care about you.
Yeah.
I mean, it was craziest. People are looking at me like, how do you know D? I don't. You know, it's a weird feeling.
Well, you must have left an impression, man.
Yeah. And another actress that was there, and you might know who she is, Meg Foster.
No, I actually know Meg pretty well because she's with my manager. And
right. And what's so crazy about Meg Foster is all I did was I walked up to her and said one simple word. You can't beat the 80s. I became her best friend that quick. She had me sitting behind her, sitting beside her at her table, hugging me. She would have let you know.
You, I don't know what you do to make such a good impression. These people love love you, man.
And when I got home, I had people with me, had the nerve to tell my wife that I was flirting. Can you? But I mean,
Meg's got the most beautiful eyes ever, perhaps. I mean, they're just mesmerizing.
And then her partner next to her hugged me as well. And that was the one from Nightmare on Elm Street, Tina.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I went, oh, my. And my family keeps looking at me like, oh, God. I'm not flirting. I'm just being who I am. You know,
Meg's a really good actress too, man.
I love Meg.
She's fantastic. I got to work with her once in a film as well, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, she was born right near me in Reading. That's where she's from. The next movie, I'm bouncing around here. You mentioned Hellblazers. I actually have it. I've not seen it yet.
I think you can see it on like Tubi or something. I think it's on Tubi.
Yep. And you played Bernard.
Yeah, I'd have to say, and I've worked with that director a few times as well, David Lee, but I'd have to say it was probably, I mean, there was so many great horror actors in that thing. I think it was a underutilized of talent. You know, there was so much talent in that thing, but most of us didn't do any like really fantastic stuff in it. You know, I was like maybe the most underutilized group of talent in a movie ever. You know, Tony was in it. Meg was in it. I was in it. I mean, it was Bruce Dern was in it. I mean, it was a really killer cast. But And oh, and Billy Zane's in it too. You know, which, you know, yeah. we've worked together before as well. I've always been a fan of Billy's work. So
yeah, Billy Zane had a movie back in early, late mid 2000s that was really good. But that being said, let's talk about. I seen the first Becky, and I was like, the actor that was in it, the comedian that was in it, really threw me off that he was in a borderline, I guess it's a horror action movie.
Yeah.
But, and then I seen this woman hater guy named Twig.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a great cast too.
Yeah. But yeah. There's Sean Scott Williams and.
Yep.
Yeah.
And your character was, I'm not saying this because I'm talking to you, other than Becky herself, you brought something special and different to that movie at the table that I wasn't expecting from Courtney Gaines.
What was up?
Well, the movies that I saw you in, you played a sheriff. You played like the good guys, you know, or, you know, but I wasn't expecting. You were a cook in that movie, correct? You're a chef too.
Well, yeah, I cooked the meal. Yeah. So there was that, which is an interesting component, right? Gives him a little something. Yes.
And I think one of the greatest scenes in that movie is with you and Becky. Yeah.
I think it might be the best, you know, death scene in the movie for sure. That's what I thought when I read it. I thought, wow, if I do this right, this is going to be the best death scene in the movie. You know?
I have kids.
Yeah. Well, you know what I like, you know, I during the pandemic I started growing out this beard, and I knew that Proud Boy type roles were going to come, you know what I mean, like those are going to be roles that were available, and they were going to be the kind of roles I can play, right? And so I build the beard, grow the beard, and it will come, and it did. And you know what, I you know, the movie is definitely you know, a revenge movie, and sort of, you know, for the, you know, for people who are angry with the left and the right, you know, chance to, you know, kill the right, as they say, you know, obviously the more extreme, the Proud Boys or the Nazis or the whatever. But my job is still to make that character human. And my job is still to make that character multidimensional. At least that's what I think. And yeah. So that's what I tried to bring to the table, is that though this guy may be flawed and he maybe have some pretty harsh opinions that maybe not everyone else agrees with, he's still a human being, you know, he's still a human being, and he still has things he loves and things he hates and things he's good at and things he's not. And but that turn at the end is absolutely fantastic. You know, when he begs for his life and then you find out what he calls. I want to tell people they haven't seen the movie, but then when he named his son, I mean, you know, guys got to go now. You know?
You made that movie.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. The movie's done really well. It got in South by Southwest, which was a really wonderful surprise. And it's done well. And I thought it came out very good. It's probably the best film I've been in a while. Ironically, the director was an actor in that movie we were talking about in Ohio, the Funhouse Massacre. He was one of the actors in Funhouse Massacre. And that's kind of how I got involved in that. I still had to audition, but you know, I had a little bit of a background with him. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, is there anything you want to talk about? We'll get to your music really shortly, but any movie roles that's coming up that you,
I can't talk about anything in the future by SAG roles, but I can talk about one other project that you didn't talk about that was recent that I think was cool is, one of the other things I did last year was I worked for Rockstar, for, you know, the video game company, which is just a huge company, you know, getting the bubble suits and all that. And it was so secretive. They wouldn't tell us what we were doing. It ended up being Grand Theft Auto Online, Los Santos Road Wars. It ended up being a two-parter. It was the first part came out in December. Second part came out in February, March. And I play this character named Lab Rat, who's the guy who makes all the drugs, all the acid. I say it's my ode to Dennis Hopper. And you can catch those. You can see those scenes online. They call them the uncut scenes or art scripted. What do they call them? But there's like four or five scenes you can see that we did that were not when people were playing video games. And I didn't even know what the character looked like. I mean, they really kept everything secret, but I really loved the way it came out. And I loved the character and had a fun time doing the show. So, I mean, to be part of the Grand Theft Auto franchise, I can't even believe it, man. I'm just like, So I had two really good projects last year that I worked on that have gone on to do some good. So you just never know. Sometimes you're hot, sometimes you're not. I'm pretty happy with the last couple of things that I've done.
Awesome. Now you've waited all this long. I actually, as you know, I'm old school. I mean, like you, and music today, most of it sucks.
And I don't know if that's just because we're old. I just think some of it just sucks. But because yeah,
I like to hear vocals, mm-hmm. not having something help me sing to make money when I cannot sing.
Right.
A lot of the rappers do that, and it annoys the shit out of me because the music sucks. Point blank. I mean, 50 Cent and them, it's different, but today's music.
Yeah. But some of this stuff now, it's like literally they just say one thing in the song. It doesn't even seem like it's a song. I'm like, that's not a song. How is this selling? That's not even a song. It's like, I went down the street. Yeah. Down the street. That's like the whole song. You're like, that's not a song, bro.
But you have an EP. It's called Courtney Gaines Safe Haven.
Yep.
When I approached you for an interview a couple weeks back, the reason why I approached you is because I noticed that you had an EP. So I figured, you know, let's kill two birds with one stone.
Right.
I listened to it. I quite enjoyed the music.
Oh, thank you.
Have you always sang? Or just, I mean, you just never did anything about it? You just all of a sudden, I'm bored.
It's been a long time coming. So I started taking guitar lessons at the same time I started taking acting lessons at 13 years old, but I knew that I was going to be an actress with a profession. So I approached that very differently than I approached as far as studying goes and stuff. I always studied as an actor. I basically learned the basics on guitar and started writing. And I just didn't want to know too much because I wanted to be able to just freely write. And that's what I've been doing for all these years. I've been writing. And I've had some bands in LA. I had an acoustic band called The Gathering. And then I put out a record in 99 called Acoustic Gains. It was songs from that I recorded with that group from the 80s all the way to the 99. And the big hit off of that, as it were, was a song called Journeyman that did well in college radio that a friend of mine's label picked up. And the crazy story with that is Matt Sorum from Guns N' Roses produced that for me because his girlfriend and my girlfriend were best friends. And he asked me if I wanted to do a song. And I said, yeah. And then he even took it one step further and got Slash to play lead on it. It was an unbelievable experience.
Oh, wow.
And so that was like, you know, so I had that little splash. Then I had a band called Ripple Street that we put out an EP and then a record. And then we recently just put out four singles in 2022. So I've always been chipping at it, but really, like everybody else during the pandemic, you start going like, wow, man, life is short. What is it you want to be doing with your time? And really, it was the music. I've been sitting on a lot of material for a lot of years. And the thing that was holding me back was just the money component, right? How much it costs to go in the studio and how am I going to recoup this? Because I'm not getting picked up by a label or anything. But what I started to learn now with technology is that you can put a home studio together to track pretty easily and pretty affordably. Yep. And so I started tracking material, and then I put out five singles that became a record called Acoustic Gains Volume 1 in 2021, and promoted that and got that out there and kind of learned about how the whole Spotify thing works and all that, which I think is just all BS. And you got to get like 1,000 spins, you get 2 cents. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see how a musician can survive on that. But so then did that. And like I said, put out 4 singles with the span Ripple Street again. And one on January 6th called The Great Divide, talking about the whole, you know, they say you got to choose this or you got to choose that. You know, like you got to be all the way to the left, you got to be all the way to the right. It's all BS. You know, united we stand, divided they conquer, united we stand, you know. So. Just, you know, I wanted to say something about what we were all going through in that regard. And so 3 of these songs that on this EP I've had for a long, long time. They were in a movie I produced and starred in called Benny Bliss and the Disciples of Greatness, which is a rock and roll movie with an anti-technology message that all culminates in the desert in the vortex at the end, where a real band plays for like a 15-minute set. Right? I play this character, Benny Bliss, who is dressed somewhere between Evel Knievel and Elvis. And I wrote three of the songs in the 4 of the songs in the movie, and 3 of these I put in there. And then I wrote three new songs, and these are all storytelling songs, and that's why I lumped them all together. Whereas, like, say, Acoustic Gains is much more personal and inner-reflective. This is just storytelling. Like, one of the new songs is called Bills in Space, and it's talking about the billionaire space race, which I think is the biggest ego trip on the planet today, personally. And I say I would like those three guys, those three most wealthy guys in the world, to put their heads together and solve world hunger and homelessness instead. I'm up to
right. Right.
So, and then one of the songs, they're all stories. Like one of the songs, Healer, is told from the point of view of a plastic surgeon convincing a woman of what she can, you know, an egotistical plastic surgeon, what he can do for her with his knife.
Wow. Safe Haven. Big Brother. Safe Haven.
You know, I wrote on bass because I have a band now called the Courtney Gaines Group that you can find us on Facebook. This has been a working band now for almost a year. I live in Savannah, and here it's a tourist town. So they've got lots of bars and restaurants where they need a band to play for the night. You have to play three 45-minute sets. They pay you. And it's all been getting my chops together and getting my band's chops together to be able to go out and promote this record next year. And it's been really good. Been gigging steady. I mean, I had two gigs this weekend and been gigging steady and getting better. Matter of fact, I'm not sure when this comes out, but today my PR company, Callhammer, is releasing a song, Good Times, which is on the record. It's the last song on the record of us playing at a festival in North Carolina at the Haunted Pyramids. And that song's going to – people are going to be able to see that too. Somebody shot it, and we ended up making it black and white. And you can see, you know, I say, go check that out. You know, if you don't think I can play or you don't think we can rock, go check that song out. It'll be out today. And you can find it on YouTube. And, you know, you can see if we can do what we do. We've been working at it pretty hard for the last year and making progress. So got a band, got this record coming out. I got this record that came out last week, and we're going to be out hitting the road trying to promote it next year. So I'm semi-retired here. I have a pension. If I don't want to act anymore, I don't have to. So, you know, I can take jobs I want, I can take jobs I don't want, and I can promote and do other things I want. And right now I'm putting a lot of energy out to also doing the music. So, and I got a label this time, which was a huge step. Fake Fangs Records, and that's where you got to go get the records is at fakefangs.com. That's the only place you can get this. You can listen to the record three times. If you like it, you can do a digi download, or you can buy a CD, limited run of CDs, and I think you get the digi package with that. So but I love it. You can listen to the song, you can listen to the record three times for free. So go check it out. You know, you don't have to buy it, just listen to the songs.
You have $8 for the disc and $7 digital.
Right. You know, a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Now, I just want to say one thing before we go. You aged yourself. I don't know how many times when that record.
Yes.
You know.
Oh, yeah. I'm not trying to hide. It is a record, man. It's a CD, nope. But it's a record. And when we finally got the CDs, I could listen to the whole thing in order without having to press buttons, just like you listen to a record back in the day, right? And it's a record, man. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. It flows together nicely, and I'm proud of that. Yep. That's the way to listen to music, not just one single at a time, you know?
I say that around the youth that I work with, okay? And they look at me like I'm 89, 100 years old when I say record. I said, whatever. You guys have no idea what music is, how it was back in the day. 8 tracks and records and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's all to right. me. To me, that's what I made. I made a record. I did the whole Spotify thing and saw how that worked, and I was like, "Yeah, it's for the birds, man."
Well, I want to give you a big thanks, Courtney, for coming on the show today. I really was glad to be able to talk to you about Children of Corn, your movie career, and your up and coming music career.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Let it go!
He wants you too, Malachi.